Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
So, the winner of the 2017 Costa Book of the Year is Inside the Wave by Helen Dunmore.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We are completely and utterly blown away. Poetry was in Mum's soul. This collection is some of the most beautiful writing she ever did in her life. And it came at the time of her death, and for us is so personal and so wonderful, but we hope it will touch a lot of people who face this thing that we all do.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
You've just heard the announcement of the winner of the 2017 Costa Book of the Year Award, which went to the late, great Helen Dunmore for her poetry collection, Inside the Wave. It was praised at the ceremony as an uplifting, beautiful collection, despite the circumstances in which it was written, as Helen was dying of cancer. She died in June last year, but that didn't stop her from winning one of the UK's most well-known literary prizes. In that clip, you heard her son, Patrick, receiving it on her behalf. Sian, you were there and you spoke to him. How was he? It must have been a very strange night for him and his sister.
Well, it's so funny because Patrick was there and his sister Tess and then their father Frank. And they had gone because Patrick said that they were only really expecting to collect the poetry category award, because the Costa Book Awards have categories for first novel, novel, biography, children's book and poetry. And they were just expecting to get the winning poetry collection. They weren't thinking they were actually a contention for the Book of the Year. And so they were already emotional because they were seeing their mother recognised, and then even more emotional because she actually won the overall prize and they weren't expecting it at all. He was a bit shell-shocked. It was very sweet.
They actually carried it really well. They didn't seem shell-shocked, did they?
They seemed very composed, but I spoke to him afterwards and he was a bit, sort of, you could see his face was a little bit tear-stained and he clearly was a bit shell-shocked and said he hadn't spoken to his dad about it because he'd sort of been whisked away to sort of do media and all this sort of thing. But you just get the sense that they're just so happy to keep talking about their mum and sort of talking about her poetry in particular, because she was so proud of that.
And it was what she started with, wasn't it? Her very first published work was a book of poetry, and her very last one.
Yeah,
which is rather nice.
It is rather nice. I mean, she does actually have a short story collection that's coming out this year in June, which she wrote mostly in the lead up to her death and handed over to Patrick and said, "This is for you to edit. Can you finish this off when I die?" Because she knew that it was not going to be in any shape to be published before she died. So he's been working on that basically ever since she passed away. And so that's going to be out in June, which is lovely.
You mentioned that it was said that rumoured. It wasn't rumoured. Actually, Wendy Holden, who's the chair of judges, actually said that it was a very close decision.
Yeah.
It possibly wasn't unanimous.
I mean, there's always this funny thing that when you go to these press things for a prize and they tell you, because they tell you about an hour before it's publicly announced, so you have to go quickly, you know, ferret away and do a quick news story for the paper. But you always ask them, like, what was the judging process like? And usually you just get some answer where they say, oh, it was unanimous and it was really quick. And she actually sat and thought about that one. And she said it took about 90 minutes, which she said was longer than normal. She said it wasn't unanimous. It was a close decision. And she said the consensus was that Dunmore's poetry collection was a lot of people's second choice. For a few people, it was their first choice, and they were very passionate about it and were clearly pushing for it to win. So everyone, she said everyone was happy because everyone really loved this book, but it wasn't necessarily the first book. She said herself that she actually preferred one of the novels, which would either be John McGregor's Reservoir 13 or the debut, which was Gail Honeyman's Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine. So it's quite interesting when you get that response, because usually they kind of, it feels like they're selling it in a way that say it's a testament to the quality of the book because it was absolutely unanimous. But it's actually more interesting when they own up and say, well, you know, we actually had to talk this through. And I think they really did talk it through because they were running about half an hour late.
There's an interesting thing that comes out of that, which is that poetry so rarely wins. It's won
yes.
8 times. And 4 of those times were the saintly, the sainted Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes.
Mm.
But 5 of the 8 were all connected with illness and death.
Yes, that was so interesting when you were researching that, and I overheard you talking about it in the office, that there's so many of them to do with either people losing partners or wives and husbands, but also dying themselves.
I mean, if you actually crunch that list, and if you take Heaney and Hughes out of it, who are sort of the patron saints of poetry, what you come down to is actually the fact that what most people look to poetry for is times of grief or ways of helping themselves to deal, to articulate very, very deep traumatized feelings. And they don't actually want very sophisticated poetry.
Well, yeah, that's what that was what Wendy Holden was saying last night, because there's been this recent fight about what poetry is, in inverted commas, whether it is the sort of highbrow thing that you associate with Heaney and Hughes, or whether it's something more along the lines of, say, what Kate Tempest does or Rupi Kaur does on Instagram, or what Holly McNish is doing on YouTube, these sort of performative poetry that is then translated to the page but is not necessarily intended just to be read alone. It's intended to be read in front of an audience of, you know, a couple hundred people. Whether that's changing the nature of poetry and whether actually it's had any sort of detrimental effect on quality, there's this whole argument going on. And Wendy Holden said last night, it's lovely to have a collection of poetry that is absolutely of the highest quality, but it's very accessible. It's not a snobby collection. It's not asking the readers to do very much beyond just absorb it and respond. Which is lovely. I mean, it's not really, you wouldn't really describe it as highbrow, but you certainly wouldn't describe it as slam poetry. It's somewhere in the middle.
It's got two elements to it. And what I think is quite interesting is that even us, we superior beings on The Guardian, we've now printed 2 of the poems. One
yes.
was a poem that was actually missed out of the first edition because it was actually written in the last 2 weeks of her life, and it was put into the reprint, and it was sent to us, and we printed that in Guardian Review,
yeah.
which is absolutely addressing directly the last few weeks of life. And then this week we printed in G2 a poem about, a very simple poem about her feeling her life had been cut off, and likening it to herself to a flower that's been cut in the garden and brought in and put in a vase. And a couple of the commenters on that poem were saying, oh, but this just isn't very sophisticated poetry. It doesn't really argue for her as a great poet. And I think that those poems spoke to that particular emotional side of poetry. But there are in this collection also poems which deal very, in quite a profound way, with Greek myth, for example.
Mm-hmm.
she had a good classical sense as well as being very invested in nature. So I think that it shows the two sides of her, but the thing that rings out are the more emotional, direct poems dealing with death.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely to do with how we view poetry in our culture now.
And I suppose it's the debate is, can you actually separate these poems from the context in which they were written? And the answer is probably not. Like, perhaps she wouldn't have even written this collection if she hadn't been dying.
It would have been a different collection.
It's a different state of mind that you're going to be writing in.
Yeah.
I mean, they were saying last night, oh, it's not a sentimental decision. We're not giving this to her because it's a nice story for someone who's dead to win a prize. But it also can't be viewed really in isolation. You do need to understand that she was dying and she was in her hospital bed as she was writing some of these poems. And of course, that lends an extra weight to them. I think it'd be a mistake to try and read them in a vacuum.
No, absolutely. And that also raises the question of whether she would have won for a different collection of poetry. Now, I don't think she would have done, because
really?
The only poets who have won who haven't been dealing with death or illness, we come back to Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes.
Mm.
You know, and that was a long time ago as well. That was
yeah.
in the 1990s. And, you know, we've moved on.
Yeah.
And the idea of a translation of Beowulf winning the Costa Book of the Year, which is populist.
Yes.
If it were at anyone else, I think it's very, very unlikely that it would do that today.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's a good winner? Were you pleased with that decision?
Yeah, I am, partly because I hope people continue to read Helen Dunmore.
Yeah.
She's such an intelligent writer. In her fiction, in her children's fiction, sort of wonderful life affirming in a non-sentimental, just because she's a damn good children's writer and a damn good novelist. And her novels of Russia and the siege of Leningrad, they're just absolutely haunting.
Mm.
So, yes, and if people buy this collection of poetry and read this collection and it sends them back to her other work, and of course, absolutely her earlier collections of poetry, they will find that they hit different notes.
Yes.
But they are always notes of quality.
And there's no way you could absolutely say that Helen Dunmore was not deserving of some recognition, because she did have quite a remarkable career. Even if this maybe poetry isn't for you, perhaps you go and discover one of her novels off the back of this, but she definitely deserves the recognition, even if she's died.
Yes, absolutely. So, thumbs up.
Yeah,
from
thumbs
us.
Up. Two Rah. Thumbs up.
Now, from poetry, we go to the second greatest pleasure in life, food. Laura Shapiro's new book, What She Ate, explores the diets of six interesting and very different women, and what is revealed about their alternately troubled and loving relationships with food. When Laura came into the studio to speak with Sian, they both made sure that they'd stocked up on chocolatey baked snacks, all in the name of research, you understand.
Your book begins, as all good things do, with Dorothy Wordsworth and some black pudding. And I just was wondering, could you lay out how you came to the idea of considering women through the food they ate?
Well, Dorothy Wordsworth was really one of my inspirations for this. What happened was, it was kind of the middle of the night and I had insomnia and I was wandering around in kind of a stupor, and I pulled a biography of Dorothy Wordsworth off the shelf, and I'm just hoping that this image of life in the Lake District is going to be so calm and soothing that it will make me very sleepy. And I'm turning the pages, and because I always kind of have an eye to the food, I was paying attention to the food of the Lake District that she was all the time kind of preparing for her brother William, the poet whom she adored. And it's, you know, somebody sends them a bushel of gooseberries and she makes a little tart, or she picks the beans from the gardener. He goes out into the orchard and brings home some apples. So it's all kind of food of the heart and food of the place. I'm turning pages. She adores him. They're eating this food. It goes on and on. Suddenly, 25 years later, William has married. Now she turns up very far from the beautiful Lake District. She's in this bleak little coal mining town. She's keeping house for a nephew. And it says, the biographer quotes something from her diary, "Dined on black puddings." It's 1829. I thought, this doesn't make sense. Where is the girl with the gooseberries? Where is the person who loved her brother so much in this rarefied little life? They're eating black pudding for dinner?
Because black pudding wasn't like something that you would aspire to eat. It was something that was kind of rough. And
very rough, very working class, poor people, very indigestible. And she had what we now think is probably colitis. In other words, she looks at black pudding on that plate. She's looking at intestinal agony. I thought, something happened here, and she's very far from the brother whom she worships beyond all. So I thought, something's going on. That black pudding is telling me something, but what is it telling me? And that's when I kind of started to get this idea to look at a life, but put the food up front. Start with the food and go into the life that way. And maybe you'll find something out that isn't in the other biographies.
And with Dorothy, I mean, a lot of the women in this book have very complicated relationships with food, and they veer from sort of loving it too much to hating it quite a lot. And Dorothy clearly associated food with love and with nurturing, and she took a real pride in cooking for her brother. You map up until the point that William married that it was all very happy, but even when William married, she continued to cook for him.
Yes, she and his wife, who was a friend of hers, Mary Hutchinson, the three of them then lived in Dove Cottage as this happy trio. You wonder how happy that trio was, but there they were. And she and Mary were both cooking. And then, she started to have children. They moved to a bigger house, Rydal Mount, down the road. William became better known and more affluent. And Dorothy, who had always worked for family members, she cooked and kept house. She worked on the poetry with him. She was what the unmarried sister is. She was like a family helpmeet. Well, after they moved to this bigger place and the children started to grow up, there was less and less of a role for her, which is why she took this gig caring for her nephew far away in this hideous town. She just thought, and she writes about it in a diary, she says, "This is where I can be most useful. To be useful," was really, that was all she could be as the unmarried sister. Mm. So she had this idea, going to take care of the nephew, that it would be Dove Cottage all over again. She would be the center of somebody's life. She would be so important because she was helping him with his work. Well, this nephew is apparently a kind of lackluster preacher. He was not, you know, the great poet of the age by a long shot. Even so, she kept kind of telling herself and thinking to herself, I believe, that this is, you know, a recreation of that time when she was so happy. And then I think the sight of that black pudding just brought it all home to her, what had really happened.
And I mean, after that point, I didn't actually know this about Dorothy Wordsworth's life, but it gets quite tragic. It sort of, her mental health deteriorates quite dramatically.
Yes, she first, her physical health goes, and then her mental health goes. What happens is that the nephew, on whose, you know, to be his companion is what she has pinned her future hopes on, he gets offered a better job as a curate in a much nicer town. He doesn't need housekeeping and companionship anymore. She's going to be sort of adrift again. At that point, she's seized with what may have been gallstones, but she's in agony. They deal with that, and then she has this kind of mental breakdown that continues for the next 20 years, and she becomes increasingly helpless and demented. At that point, her relationship to food changes. Mm. This is somebody who has always worked for other people and taken care of other people. Now she is helpless, and she needs kind of 24/7, round-the-clock care from other people, and she loves it. She loves being the center of attention, the center of all the love and concern. She was never like this, but she becomes totally narcissistic in her dementia. But the dementia is a kind of freeing. This is my reading of it. Dementia is not a wonderful disease, but I kind of see it as her second chance.
A bit of rebellion in there.
Yes. And what she does is demand food constantly. She's never done this. You never, in all her diaries, you don't see her saying, you know, gee, I was hungry, I was starved, couldn't wait. You never see any of that. Now she's talking about it all the time. All she wants is something to eat. And, you know, you don't love me, that's why you're not feeding me. More, more, more. And she's clamoring for food every minute. Well, what's she clamoring for? It's love. It's attention. It's to be important. It's to know that people care about her. It's to kind of rule her kingdom, if she can possibly do that at the end of her life. So it's a tragedy, and it's a tiny bit of a triumph, too.
And I suppose that connection between food and importance and providing food links very nicely to Rosa Lewis, who I had not heard of. But she sort of started as this Cockney scullery maid and sort of ended up being a favourite of King Edward VII.
Yes, it's a real food and class story. What's fascinating about her, you know, she was the person that the old television, public television series, The Duchess of Duke Street, was loosely based on her life. So here she is, a scullery maid at the age of 12. She goes out to work. She somehow, we're not sure how, manages to learn this very ornate, expensive French cooking of the time that you did. If you were rich and in London, this is what you wanted to eat, this fancy French cooking. So she learned to do that. And in that way, she rose up the ranks. But she did it completely consciously. She had this idea that to be accepted by the lords and ladies, that was her goal in life. What's interesting was, it was not like Eliza Doolittle, not like My Fair Lady, where she learns to put aside her Cockney accent and to dress and act like a duchess so that she will be taken for a duchess. That is not Rosa Lewis's approach. She keeps her accent. She keeps her all her kind of mannerisms and the slang that she used and all that. She wants to be treated like a duchess, but to be herself. She wants to be the cook, but be accepted as the cook. It's a very difficult balancing act, and the class story was more complicated and difficult than even she knew. So she was accepted by the king. She was accepted by the lords and ladies. World War I comes along. Mm. That whole system falls apart. After the war, there's no money for cooking like that. The whole thing that she became famous on has sort of disintegrated. She stops cooking. She's kind of put aside by all the people that she's sort of entrusted her identity to. She's like the aging governess that you don't know what to do. She insists on sitting at the dinner table with you and you're embarrassed to have her there. She's outlived her usefulness. It's a heart-rending ending, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned in the book about Evelyn Waugh that it's quite a transparent parody of Rosa Lewis, but there's the character Lottie Crump, who is a hotel owner who rambles on about all the rich people that she knows. And it's clearly a joke about Rosa Lewis, who had this hotel called the Cavendish. And
yes,
it all got a bit shambolic towards the end.
Absolutely. Oh, she hated Evelyn Waugh. After he wrote that, she would have nothing to do with him.
I suppose, food gave her social mobility because food was so important. But reading about the dinners and the lunches during the Edwardian era is just—it sounds appalling.
I know, it's astonishing.
You gave a few examples of what the average meal was like, but there was the description that there were two soups to start. It's usually one thin and one thick, two kinds of fish, three entrees, one or two removes, which are sort of roasts, and if you had two, then the second would be chicken, and there'd be game dishes, and then these etrements, pretty dishes, these sort of nice tagines and things, and then dessert.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of accounts in this book from that Rosa Lewis chapter of people that didn't really sound like they enjoyed food very much after meals like that.
No, in fact, the people, they would go to these dinners night after night during the social season. It's like one after the other. Not only these elaborate long dinners, but you're sitting next to the same person because all the seating was by social rank. So you're always next to the same people. What on earth do you talk about? And you're always saying, as one etiquette guide says, you just get tiresome saying no thank you to every other course, which they did, but they had to do it that way.
And then speaking of people that don't enjoy food, there's Eleanor Roosevelt, who's the third woman in your book, who had the reputation for not enjoying food because the food was so appallingly bad in the White House when she and FDR were there. But you argue in your chapter about Eleanor that the bad food was more an indication of kind of the opposite, that she was more troubled by her role as First Lady as opposed to the things that came with that, like providing the food. And
she had a huge streak of austerity, and you know, she was just a complete do-gooder. She was the great progressive of our time, the greatest activist, forward-thinking First Lady we have ever had in the United States. So she did all kinds of great stuff that way, but she had this puritanical streak that was well known. She didn't care about clothes and she didn't care about food, and everybody said that about her. What I found, and I was so happy to find it, because we love Eleanor Roosevelt, and we hate the idea that she never had a decent meal or cared about it and didn't like food, but she did, it turns out. Because after FDR died, she went on to a fabulous second career. She became a kind of public conscience in the United States, worked for the UN, worked for human rights, was a kind of political mentor to many Democrats. So she had this great other career. And all her life, all her adult life, really, she wrote a daily syndicated newspaper column. So you can easily see what she was up to. And again, in this post-White House life, she drops in a little mention of some wonderful meal that she had. You know, it's just, oh, we were in Paris and I loved the food, she'll say. Or we went to Beirut and had this delicious dish of lamb. And you see those things and your heart just leaps up. And really what it was that being confined in the White House, she had never wanted to be First Lady. She did not love being married to FDR. He had a history of infidelity, and she kind of dealt with that all her life and hated it. And it was a difficult marriage, and the two of them were, I believe, it was just kind of parallel lives. They had a political partnership, but that was all. Mm. So there is a school of thought, and her wonderful biographer, Blanche Weazin Cook, believes this, that these terrible meals in the White House were just a way of telling FDR, kind of reasserting her power and saying, you know, look, I know what's going on here. and this her biographer says these meals were ER's revenge.
Well, I love the detail that you had about Hemingway visiting in 37 and saying it was the worst meal he'd ever had. But before that, he'd gotten on the plane and Martha Gellhorn was just scoffing sandwiches because she knew the food was going to be bad and she just knew she didn't want to eat. So good. I mean, I suppose as well, her time in the White House corresponds with the Great Depression, and it sort of makes sense that food is not going to be an opulent thing, that it's basically about scrimping wherever you can, and often that's going to be flavor, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, to have very simple meals was definitely her goal in the White House for good reasons. She did not think the White House should be a showplace for, you know, high living and luxury living and so forth, so she wanted simple meals. But as you know, if you can cook, you can make a good simple meal. You don't have to spend a lot of money on food, even in the White House, if you know how to cook. And she had hired a housekeeper who knew nothing about cooking or housekeeping. She was kind of someone Eleanor knew and thought she should have a job, so she let her do this. So the food was going to be terrible. The other thing that happened was that one of the many progressive causes that Eleanor adopted was the home economics movement, which has been really all around the world, home science, domestic science. In the States, it was called home economics. And it was the school of thought that said that women should go to school to learn to be good housewives and good homemakers, and you should study chemistry and physiology and biology and nutrition, not to be a scientist, but to be a good wife. Eleanor Roosevelt, who probably never washed a dish in her entire life, she loved this, and she loved it because it turned women's role into a management role. It stripped it of the sentiment, and she was a completely unsentimental person, and she felt she had failed at all the things a woman should be able to do, have a good marriage, be a good mother. She thought she was a failure at all those things, but she could be a success as a domestic manager. She loved that idea. There was a kind of definition of femininity that she could live up to. So she was devoted to this movement. And at the heart of this movement were these very simple, nutritious meals that people should be cooking.
And the fourth woman in your book, it struck me as a remarkable addition, is Eva Braun, who is not someone you really associate with food. You know, it's not the first thing you think about her. I mean, how did she come to be in the book? Because she has an almost hatred for food.
Well, she looked on food, as she looked on many things, as a kind of servant to her. She could turn it to her own use. She ate very lightly, so she'd eat a little fruit or a salad or something. This is during World War II when there was no fruit and there were no salads. But, of course, if you're Eva Braun, there were. So she wanted to always stay slim and be beautiful, so she was able to master food, to bring it under her domain, and that was her way of kind of proceeding in life as the consort of a Nazi. She chose that life. I put her in the book because she had a role, because she made those choices that seem inexplicable to me. I can't get a grip on her, really, even now. Why would you do that? She was this pretty teenager. He was a almost middle-aged, homely, rising Nazi star. I mean, what is the attraction? But somehow this grabbed her, and she devoted her life to him. She just did. And so I wanted to get to that. I wanted to somehow figure, what's in it for her? Well, it's a class change. She was kind of brainless, but she read a lot of movie magazines and fashion magazines, and this kind of fed this fantasy that she had. She would be, as she used to put it, the first lady of the Reich. She would be the leading. Hitler told her he would make a movie about their life together at the end of the war, and she would star in it. This is the kind of thing that she lived for. And the relation to food was this, that she didn't have many places to play out this fantasy. She wasn't allowed to be seen in public. Nobody was supposed to know he had a mistress. So the only time that she got to kind of be the consort and the first lady of the Reich was at more or less private lunches and dinners with Hitler and this Nazi entourage and their families and her own family. So they would sit at this enormous table at Berchtesgaden, his Bavarian retreat, and she could play the role of the kind of eternal feminine spirit, the beautifully dressed, lighthearted, never talk about politics, everything is cheerful, and it chat about movies and things, and she's always beautifully gowned. She's like the essence of femininity. She's like stereotypical femininity. And to me, and because that plays out at the table, to me it becomes a kind of subversion or a horrible comment on the greatest cliche about food that we have, which is that food is love, food is community, food brings us together, family dinner is the most wonderful, important meal. Well, these were family dinners. Nazis had family dinners. It brought them together. It allowed them to kind of bask in this feminine glow that made everything okay. She created a guilt-free zone in the heart of Hitlerdom. So these generals come and sit down, and they've just been murdering babies, but now they can sit down at this table and feel good because there's a woman at the table who's eternally female. That's kind of the picture.
It never picks up her fork and knife.
Right. Yes, exactly.
In contrast to that, a woman who loved food and really celebrated the sharing of food in her novels is Barbara Pym, who, when I saw you had put a chapter about her, I was so pleased because the scenes with food in her books are just meant to be almost enjoyed like food, like the detail of it. And you always know, she always details the meals that they're having and who's cooked what and that sort of thing.
She herself used to say that she was, you know, annoyed when novelists left out the food or memoirists didn't tell you. She said she wanted to know. So when she wrote, she put it in. Every meal gets in there. And in her own letters and diaries, she's always telling you what she ate. So for me, this was wonderful. What
perfect.
Fabulous research. You can just, that was just great. But when you look at those food scenes, not only do you learn everything about the characters, you see so much about them. Are they making bœuf à la mode or are they opening a tin of spaghetti? It happens. Both of those things happen in these books, and it tells you who these people are. It also, I think, does this complete revision of our stereotype of post-war British cooking, which has a terrible reputation. Yeah. You never hear people sitting around nostalgically, you know, dreaming about those great days of 1950 British food. But the fact is, a lot of that food was perfectly good. And we know that because it shows up that way in her novels. They'll make a little salad with olive oil and lettuce and serve it with a nice fresh cheese and a beautiful piece of bread, and there's a glass of wine. I mean, Elizabeth David started telling people to do that in the early 50s. Barbara Pym was putting it in her novels before that. So that says to me that you could be an ordinary person in the decades after World War II and really have a very nice food life. Mm. And I think that comes out hugely. And then for her, as a novelist, it's just such an unerring key to character. And what's wonderful is that the whole idea of gourmet, that was ridiculous. She had no interest in anything. Delicious food, yes, but gourmet and all the pretension and things that went around that, she just totally made fun of. She has one character who's a restaurant reviewer. She just skewers him because she really finds it ridiculous.
What was her relationship to food personally? Is it?
You know, she ate the kind of ordinary things that a middle-class educated British person would eat at mid-century. They had sausages and they had cauliflower cheese and they had summer pudding. I love all this stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it was, and she bought olive oil. She did a lot of home baking, but she also got Miracle Whip, you know, the faux mayonnaise. She gave fish fingers a try. So she bought wine, she bought Coca-Cola, she got Marmite, she got something called Twiglets, which I understand are all the rage in this country. I don't know what they are.
Strange little sticks.
Yes. So food was a friend to her. And I would say of all the women in this book, she's the one who made a friend of food. Mm. She had an easy, happy, uncomplicated relationship with it. She enjoyed high-end meals, low-end meals, a candy bar, a delicious pastry, whatever it was. She ate it in a good spirit. She's like a role model for a healthy attitude towards food.
Well, speaking of healthy attitudes towards food, the last woman in your book, Helen Gurley Brown, who I had not heard of before reading your book, but such an interesting woman. She was editor of Cosmo for 32 years.
Yes, and she started out as a kind of normal person. Then in 1962, she published a book called Sex and the Single Girl, which made a huge hit in the United States, sold a trillion copies, and was republished forever. And that book was about how to be young and skinny and sexy and find happiness. And it was so successful that Helen Gurley Brown kind of identified with that book and that creature forever, and that became her rule in life. It became the message of Cosmopolitan magazine. She's talked about it over and over. Well, you can't be young and sexy and skinny forever without going to very dramatic extremes. And she went to them. Tons of plastic surgery, rigorous, insane diets that she did. And then this kind of fantasy that all of this at the age of 40, 50, 60, 70, and 80 was making her sexy. Mm-hmm. And she talked about it all the time. So it's this odd self-creation that kind of ran away with her. But what's interesting was she's also the only person in this book who wrote a cookbook. She published a 400-page cookbook. She knew that eating, sharing food with a man, these are sexy events. She knew that. She wanted to kind of give homage to that, as well as to not eating and also be sexy. This got her into the most psychological and rhetorical tangles. She'd be interviewed by one person and say how much she loved food and loved to eat, and pasta's her favorite dish. And the next person comes along and interviews her and says, well, I never eat. I'd much prefer to be hungry. I always pass it to the next person. I never take it myself. It's the same person, but completely, it's like a culinary minefield that she's constantly walking through. What's interesting to me is that she was absolutely sure-footed on every other subject. She knew what she thought, she knew what she wanted to tell people, but on food, everything in the magazine and in her books and in her interviews and things, just in a state of collapse. Food threw her for a loop. It really did.
Yeah, it was so interesting reading her and what you said about the pasta, sort of boasting about loving a big bowl of pasta, but then feeling this huge amount of guilt about wanting that.
Yeah.
That is very much an attitude that exists among a lot of women now, a lot of women today, and things that you see on Instagram that, you know, people putting up photos of these big bits of food that they're never actually going to eat. It's more about the boast of possibly enjoying something that you know you really shouldn't for whatever reason.
I think she really anticipated exactly that weirdness. She would have seen it coming, yes.
I mean, your book is all about women and it's all about that relationship and how it differs for all these women. But could you do a book about men and have it be such an emotional relationship? Because there is this sort of association with thinness and beauty with women.
Yes, and there's also, I don't know, I think there's an intimacy about women's relation to food that's just, I think it's in our DNA. I don't want to be a generalist and say all women are like this, but I just have a sense that there's a sort of a close contact with women and food, certainly with women in cooking, but even with women and food, that isn't there with men. Now, I don't know, some man would have to write this book and tell me. I could never think like a man. But to me, it would be a stretch. I feel as though the relationship with men would be much more intellectual is the wrong word, but more somewhat more objective, maybe. Mm. I don't know, maybe not. Or else it would be an intimate relationship that was so deeply buried and distorted and weirded out by being male, which, as we know, is a weird condition to begin with, that you'd have a hard time getting to it. I would have a hard time getting to it. I hand this subject to some wonderful male writer with, you know, good luck.
We'll see what happens.
Laura Shapiro's What She Ate is published by Fourth Estate.
On next week's show, as we enter LGBT History Month, we'll be meeting up with Christine Burns, the editor of a new anthology of writing about transgender lives, Trans Britain.
Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead,
me, Sian Kane,
and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.